When Buddhism went to China, it got influenced by the I Ching, the idea that each moment is unique. There are thousands of different ways that the I Ching would describe what is appropriate for that particular moment. And so you had to be sensitive to the particulars to decide what would be right or wrong in that particular case. Everything was relative to what the moment told you, or how you intuited the moment, which is very different from the Buddha's original way of teaching. He said there are certain principles you hold on to no matter what, and they give you a framework for dealing with whatever present moment comes up, without exception. There's the principle of appropriate attention, which the Buddha explains in two connected ways. One is the principle that skillful action should be developed, unskillful action should be abandoned. And the Buddha gives a list of what counts as skillful and what counts as unskillful. And you take that as the framework for approaching every present moment. A lot of the principles of what's skillful and what's unskillful relate to the precepts. Which means the precepts always come first. Because it's all too easy to say, well, this situation is such that we have to abandon that precept, or that situation is such that we have to abandon this precept because we're going to suffer for this or that loss. But the Buddha reminded you there are serious losses and losses that are not serious. And the serious ones are loss of right view and loss of your virtue. The ones that are not serious, the kinds of things that the world takes seriously, like loss of wealth, loss of health, loss of your relatives. The Buddha said those are minor. You lose those things and you get them back. If not in this lifetime, another lifetime. They come and they go. But if you lose your virtue, you lose your views, right views, then it's going to be serious. And in this way, the precepts protect us from getting upset, worked up about worldly affairs. Or the news that comes in, this person has done that horrible thing, that person has done this horrible thing. And people say, well, we have to do something to stop them. Well, yes, you do what you can within the precepts. That's because people abandon the precepts so quickly that they don't realize that there are ways of dealing with difficult situations, staying within the precepts. If you use your ingenuity enough, you'll find what those ways are, so you can minimize the losses. Other times, there are times when you simply have to accept the fact that you will lose things, but you hold on to your precepts. I'm frequently reminded of a veteran from the Vietnam War I heard being interviewed one time. Apparently he had shot an innocent girl during the war, and that memory came back to haunt him every night. He said that if he had $1 million to pay to go back and undo that deed, he would happily pay that $1 million. But even no matter how much money you have, you can't go back and undo the things you've done. So it's best to have some rules that you hold on to beforehand. That no matter what anybody says and what it tells you, no matter what anybody does, you're not going to break your precepts. And that protects you from that kind of regret. So we do hold on to this framework as our way of approaching each moment, because there's nothing special about any moment that lies outside of this principle of developing what's skillful and abandoning what's unskillful. Simply that as the practice progresses, that principle gets developed even further into the Four Noble Truths. What you develop is the Noble Eightfold Path, which you abandon is craving. Because you realize that when you can abandon craving, you can put an end to suffering. You develop the Eightfold Path so that you can abandon the craving and be done with the suffering. Again, you've got this framework for approaching each moment. This is one of the functions of mindfulness, is to keep that framework in mind. When something comes up, you know what to do with it. For instance, with the hindrances, those are part of the cause of suffering, so you know you have to abandon them. And again, there's a framework you want to keep in mind, because it's all too easy when the hindrances arise to fall in with them. A sensual desire comes along. There's a part of the mind that says, yes, this object really is worthy of this kind of desire. When ill will comes, that person really does deserve to suffer. When you feel sleepy, oh yes, you need to sleep, and so on down the line. So if you keep that framework in mind, recognize what sensual desire is and recognize it as a hindrance and something to be abandoned, then you know what to do. And you don't listen to the voices that tell you otherwise. As for the clinging aggregates, those are to be comprehended. What does comprehension mean? It doesn't mean you simply notice, oh yes, there is suffering, or this is what suffering is like. You understand, suffering is in the clinging to the aggregates. And why do you cling to the aggregates? Because you find pleasure out of them. Some people will say you think that they have some abiding essence, and that's why you hold on to them. But that, I've never seen that as the reason, say, that I would hold on to a cup of, that I like my mug. I like my mug because it works. It seems to repay whatever effort I put into maintaining it. In other words, you see that the pleasure is worth it. No matter how much effort goes into it, the pleasure is worth it. And so to comprehend that means to see, well, it's not really worth it. This is why we have the contemplation of the body into 32 parts. You think of all the grief that goes into finding somebody that you lust for and having the relationship that you want. For the sake of what? Go down the parts of the body. Okay, which are the ones that you really think have the value, that repay you? Well, it turns out the parts of the body are not what repay you. There's something else going on in the mind. That's the way the mind paints pictures about the relationship. Often it's not so much focused on the object itself, but it's you in your fantasies. But you have to ask, are the fantasies worth it? What do you get out of them? And John Lee's images of a dog gnawing on some bones that have no meat at all. What does it get out of it? Well, the taste of its own saliva. Think about that. So this is what it means to comprehend the aggregates. You try to see what aggregate are you holding on to? What are you clinging to? And is it worth it? We can loosen up some of your attachment to the objects that you're clinging to. Then you begin to turn around and look at the craving. And as the Buddha said, we take craving as our friend. Everything it tells us to do, we do, believing it 100%, thinking that it's got our best interests in mind. But no, it's the kind of friend that gets you to break the law, and then when the police come, it goes running off. I've never seen craving go to hell, never seen craving suffer. Craving just keeps on coming and coming and coming, but it gets you to suffer. As for things to develop, there's the Noble Eightfold Path, or the Seven Factors for Awakening. When you have some mindfulness, maintain it, nurture it, turn it into right mindfulness. Analyze things into what's skillful and what's unskillful. Okay, that's something you hold on to. Try to develop it so it gets more and more precise. As the Buddha said, you start out with basic dualities in the mind. You see what's skillful and what's not, what mind states are bright, he says, what mind states are dark. You're able to make those distinctions, and then based on that, you work on your persistence to give rise to what's skillful and to get rid of what's not. As the Buddha said, you know, appropriate attention underlies all of the factors for awakening. Because once you can exercise your persistence, get rid of those unskillful qualities, the mind is going to feel rapture, going to feel quietness. It's going to get concentrated. And from the concentration, as it develops, the feelings get more refined, your perceptions get more refined. And you get to a state of really solid equanimity, where you can see things as they're happening very clearly. This is, the Buddha said, this is where mindfulness becomes pure. Okay, these are things to develop in as many circumstances as you can muster it. So the Buddha is giving us a framework to apply to every present moment. So we realize that each moment, even though it doesn't have, it has its unique features, it's not the unique features that matter. It's how things fit into that framework. Because the framework is what gives you guidance. This is what the teachings are all about. The Buddha didn't set out the Four Noble Truths just to say, here's some interesting facts to file away in your list of trivia. These are facts that are meant to do something for you. As the Buddha said, we start out with this desire to get rid of suffering. Here he's offering these facts for that, the sake of that. They're facts with a purpose. Implicit duties, and for you to take and use in line with those duties. So the framework is not being imposed on you. Our relationship to the Buddha is special. Postmodern people tell us that everybody telling you what you should do is basically trying to exert power over you. But that doesn't apply to the Buddha. He found something really good and he wants to share it out of compassion. And if you have compassion for yourself, you adopt this framework. Listen to its guidance, follow its guidance. And you can't go wrong. You're wrong only when you try to make concessions. And you're the one who'll suffer. And then sometimes, following your example, other people will suffer too. So both for their sake and for your sake, keep this framework in mind. The framework of what's skillful, the framework of appropriate attention. Before your long-term welfare and happiness.